Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Pip Drysdale. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. At Final Draft, we're dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week, we look into the issues that drive our storytelling and help you discover more from the books that you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gundungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to the lands. This is stolen land. Treaty was never made in Australia. Pip Drysdale is an actor, a musician, and a writer. She's the author of The Sunday Girl and The Strangers We Know, which is currently in production for a TV adaptation. Today, Pip is joining me to discuss her latest novel, The Paris Affair. Harper Brown has arrived in Paris to live her dream. She's leaving her romantic baggage behind and starting a job at an online magazine as its new art and culture writer. This is Paris, and a small borrowed apartment and rude co-workers are just part of the charm. Except Harper's nourishing dreams of becoming a hard-hitting reporter, and the arrogant git who currently does that job is ignoring her warnings that a serial killer may be stalking women on the streets of Paris. Join me as we discover Pip Drysdale's The Paris Affair. Pip, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for the journey you've taken me on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for chatting. I actually have to say, The Paris Affair has been on my mind probably for the last month. It's been almost a month, I think, since I read it. And I think my thinking has flipped and changed and all sorts of things. So I'm really excited for this chat. Do you mind if we touch on a couple of things before we get started?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. First things first. I was thinking about how to approach the interview, of course, like any new book that has a mystery element, you want to be, you know, very circumspect about that. There's not a lot of fun to revealing too much.
Yeah, you've got to be really careful, especially with this book, because, like, for example, when I was doing the elevator pitch, I had to be super careful what I said and didn't say, because you don't want to ruin it, you know?
Absolutely. Now, but the way my thinking has sort of moved me, what I'd like to approach doesn't go particularly anywhere near the mystery so much, but it does. I really wanted to tap in, and I think one of the reasons it's been on my mind is, of course, all of the very grim news that is a part of constant discussion, particularly around violence against women at the moment. And what you really got me thinking with the Paris Affair was the way Harper's story so much kind of hinges around those ideas of situational awareness and...
Yeah.
And so I thought we could explore that, and without going into the nuts and bolts of the mystery, we can look at how that aspect of our society and our culture plays out in a mystery like this. You're not dealing with a Poirot type who's going to, you know, very dryly just observe the facts. You have a protagonist who has a stake in the game, and it's very much baked into her character. Now, I'm really excited to get into this and the story that you've crafted around your main character, Harper Brown. But I thought I'd just let people know at the beginning, at the outset, that this story is going to touch on some issues that people may find confronting. And just pop a content warning on that in case people might want to tune out. But let's get into it, because Harper Brown, your protagonist, has arrived in Paris to live her dream. She's leaving her romantic baggage behind and starting a job at an online magazine as its new art and culture writer. Now, this is Paris, a small borrowed apartment and rude co-workers. They're just part of the charm, except Harper's nourishing dreams of becoming a hard-hitting reporter. And the arrogant git currently doing that job is ignoring her warnings that a serial killer may be stalking women on the streets of Paris. I love this setup because Harper is very much an underdog, but she's no usual underdog because she's seemingly got most of her stuff together, and she's incredibly strong I want to get it out of the way at the outset that The Paris Affair is a tight action mystery, and usually I'd be super worried about spoilers right now. But despite the thrills and twists, I want us to focus on something very particular about the character of Harper that informs her story, but is tragically all too relevant to our world right now. Now, at the beginning, Harper, she's brand new at the Paris Observer, but she's built her reputation with a blog, How to Not Get Murdered. And this is kind of, I felt like it was part Chekhov's gun, but part this hyper-real situational awareness guide for women. I guess some people would like to believe that, you know, a spate of horrible stories about violence against women is an anomaly, but truthfully, this is a situation that's always existed. I wondered where this blog idea and Harper's backstory came from for you.
To be honest, I have pretty much spent my entire life cataloging ways to not get murdered. So, and I have picked up tricks and tips from podcasts. I've picked them up from true crime documentaries I've watched on Netflix. I've picked them up from true crime novels. And I don't know that I'm that unique like that. I think a lot of women probably do that. You know, you think things like, don't walk up to a panel van. And, because you read something in the newspaper about a woman who was pulled into a panel van. So you learn to be wary of those sorts of things. And I can't even tell you how big the catalogue in my brain is of things you should and shouldn't do in order to not get murdered, which is truly sad, but it's just how it is.
I probably should have done a Google search before we started chatting. So I don't know, but does anything like this exist out there? Because, I mean, you're absolutely right. It sounds
really
like,
sure.
Yeah.
I'm not actually really sure. I hope so. But whenever I listen to a true crime podcast, what I'm listening for, I mean, apart from the story and the horror of it, is I'm kind of listening for what happened and how could it have gone differently and what could you possibly have done differently? Because I suppose that's the only way that I get a sense of kind of agency, because otherwise you are quite vulnerable.
I feel like as viewers of stories, we get that sort of frisson of excitement in, say, a horror movie, screaming at the screen saying, don't go down to the basement, because, of course, yeah, we know that's what's going to happen. But that's a luxury of sitting on your couch on a Friday night. Does it make you angry to know that this is something that you have to do and that it is such an important part of your character's story?
Lots of things make me angry about the world, but and this is probably one of them. But I also think that to create a character like Harper, she has to live in the real world, and she has to be responding to it the way that I would, for example. And so it was a necessary part of her character development. But would I prefer that we lived in a world where a woman didn't have to do that? Of course I would. I mean, does it make me angry? Of course it does. I'm sure it makes every woman angry. It probably makes a lot of men angry too.
So when we meet Harper, she's in the process of explaining how to lose a guy in 3 minutes. Now, this scene plays on power dynamics in relationships, and here we have Harper firmly in control. Did you want the Paris Affair to explore these gendered ideas of power?
Yes, and I really wanted them to break down the idea that all women are desperately looking for a happily ever after, and that it's men trying to avoid relationships and not women, because I don't believe that every woman falls into that prototype. So, that's why I made it that way.
And her latest assignment, I mean, I think it's only her fourth for the Paris Observer. It's taking her to a launch of the hottest new artist in town, Noah X. I was really interested in the way that both Harper and Noah, in their first meetings, they hide their identities from each other. And of course, there are very interesting story reasons for this, but I felt like it also kind of mirrored the way people are able to dissemble and to play roles in their online romantic lives, and how this isn't always an equal power relationship. Like, what did you want to explore about identity here?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, how can I put that into a succinct little two-liner?
Take all the lines you want.
When I write a book, for example, there's so much to it. It is so nuanced, and there's so much going on, and it alters and changes. And half the time, I'm learning what I think and what I believe and what I'm trying to say as I'm working. So I will start out with a plot, for example, but thematically, I will learn a lot as I go, and then I will try to distill what I've realized I'm trying to say, right? So, yes, I was definitely playing with the whole idea that these days you don't really know exactly who you're getting in a relationship with a lot of the time. We think we do, but we're only presented by what's available online about people and what they tell us, and often the truth is really different to that. And for all I know, that's what it was like a long time ago as well. But I can only speak to my own personal experiences of dating now, right? And so, yeah, I suppose I was trying to explore that.
I guess at the heart of that kind of power dynamic also is what is held back. Now, of course, what's being held back is the heart of any mystery. You as the writer, and I mean, luckily me, I've read the book now. I know what's happening. We're working hard to hold back what we know. But in that relationship, in that burgeoning relationship, in all of Harper's relationships, because she's about 28 years old. She's in a city that she knows but is not a native of. She is very vulnerable to what she doesn't know. How does that dynamic of holding back kind of play out in the world that you see?
What do you mean by holding back? I'm
skirting really very much around the particular characters, because I don't want to reveal obviously what different characters are holding back. But that idea that we drip feed people and that we only show people what they need to know, do you see that as a barrier perhaps to us building relationships?
I actually do. I really do. And ironically, in my own personal relationships, I tend to be quite direct and very open about things about myself, only because I feel like that's the only way to truly build connection. But I said that I've been deeply frustrated by the fact that the world in general doesn't seem to work that way. So it probably is my way of exploring that.
It's really interesting how necessary it becomes, though, because One of the very essential characters and really interesting relationships is between Harper and her best friend. And I say it's a really interesting relationship because it's allowed to exist in parallel to, I guess, what we might call the driving mystery of the narrative. And Harper also deliberately holds back. She holds back for reasons of the concern and not wanting to worry her friend. And The way we can slip into those patterns, even with the people that we care the most about.
It's usually with the people we care the most about, because you're trying to protect them, or mainly it's because you're trying to protect them. So
So as we move forward, we learn that Paris is gripped by the disappearance of a young woman. And that there's a lack of developments in the case. It means that the media is losing interest, that the police are potentially not going to be pursuing it for much longer. I mean, I feel like this is something that we know too well in our day-to-day experience of the world and media.
Yeah.
I wondered as you were writing this, what you were thinking about the role that public interest plays in the ways that we view violent crime.
Well, that's actually a really interesting question, because when I was writing it, one of the things that I really had to work around was the way that crimes like this are investigated in France, which isn't the same way that they're investigated in other places. For example, in France, people have the right to disappear. And so the police will only investigate a crime if there's obvious proof that there was foul play. So if somebody saw you being kidnapped or they found a body, or if you were a minor. So I had to really work around that, which is, I can't really say too much without ruining the plot, but that really played into a lot of the choices that I made about how stories got out there. Because, for example, in France, the police don't use the media to reach out to the public. So it's not like in the States, for example, and even in Australia, where the police will ask the media to please ask the public for help or if they've seen anything. In France, there is a very clear divide between the media and the police. And so I needed to be very careful to make the story and the way that it was dealt with reflect that so that it was realistic.
I wondered if we could move into the digital realm for a moment here, because obviously the way we engage is hugely influenced by the media we consume, and there is just a plethora of media out there. And I mean, really conspicuous in the story is that Harper has this love of true crime podcasts, which, I mean, that's a huge part of the population. They are so hot right now. I wonder if you think back to a time before there were true crime podcasts, do you think that they have changed the narrative, this idea that there will always be an investigator who will go out and give us closure, will give us a sense of an ending?
Ooh, I don't know. You know, I haven't really given that much thought. I suppose, I think when I think of true crime podcasts, the thing that, I mean, I love them. Don't get me wrong. I listen to so many of them. But I think the thing that concerns me about them is simply that there is a sense of celebrity given to killers that I don't love. Mm. But whether I'm trying to think of whether there have actually been situations where true crime podcasts have solved a crime that the police haven't. I'm not actually 100% sure about that. For example, I was recently watching this documentary about the Cecil Hotel in LA on Netflix. I don't know if you've seen it, but it sort of showed how sometimes when people try to investigate crimes themselves and they don't have all the information, they can end up ruining the lives of people who didn't do anything wrong. And that was my great takeaway from that. I only watched it recently. Highly recommend it to anyone listening. I can't remember the exact name, though. I think it's called something about Vanishing and the Cecil Hotel, but I found it fascinating. Mm. Sorry, what was the question? I feel like I've gone off on a total tangent.
Not at all. I'm really just intrigued by you were describing a particularly a particularly cultural and I guess socio-political situation in France where the way they investigate is guided by the rules that they have around a person's right to disappear. But then we also see sort of worldwide social media makes us engage with these stories in a very
That's why I included it. That's why I included the social media aspect with in the Paris affair in terms of looking for one of the girls who is missing. I really needed to include social media because that's how it plays out. Mm. Often if things are not being investigated in a way that people might want, they will take things into their own hands and it will go viral. So I really wanted to reflect that in the book. Sometimes people ask me things like why I use social media in my novels. But to me, I feel like if you're writing a contemporary novel, it would be really hard not to include social media because if you're looking into a crime, I mean, what's your alternative to go like rifle through someone's rubbish? It feels like you'd have to be a bit silly not to get onto the internet and do a quick Google search or look at social media or post something on social media, you know?
I want to bring something up about also about your use of social media, which I loved. And I think you're absolutely right. This need to reflect the reality, but also the dangers that exist in our in our contemporary world. And I'm going to skirt very carefully around the where this sits within the plot. But I mean, in the broader kind of tech debate that we have, there's a whole lot of discussion in many jurisdictions around what rights bodies like the police will have to access data to help them solve a crime. And yet there is a moment in the Paris affair where some very publicly available data seems to cause a particularly fraught situation for Harper. And I guess for a lot of people reading the book, that would make them jump straight into their settings. You go, okay, geolocation, I'm just going to make sure that I'm not giving away more than I plan to give away when I start posting.
Yes, however, and I don't know exactly which plot point you're talking about because there's like so many of them.
It's good the way I did that. I've not spoiled anything.
I know, you did so well. However, I did actually make sure in a couple of the points in the book that it wasn't really reliant on, for example, geolocation settings, that they were clues within social media that could be relied upon as opposed to bad security settings.
And now that you've pointed that out, let's just go delete all our social media accounts.
It's so hard to talk about this book and to be candid without ruining it for someone. And I'm trying so hard.
But no, I mean, I think it's brilliant. And you do, you expose how vulnerable we can leave ourselves. And I guess we've circled back around to this idea of situational awareness. What we're discussing here is the person who is trying to live their own life having to be, and in this case we're talking about your protagonist, Harper, we're talking about her needing to be constantly aware at the possibility that there is danger. And that's what I feel like you've explored so amazingly in The Paris Affair, because, of course, we want to strive for a world where people are not feeling so vulnerable that they have to check their every movement. But, of course, that's not the world that we live in.
No, and it feels like we're getting further and further from that ideal world, but it's hard to know because maybe it's just that we're more aware of it, was there a question? I think I missed it.
No, I tend to drop just comments.
I was like, crap.
Occasionally I'll do like a little rising intonation at the end to imply a question. Now, as the story moves forward, another woman has been found murdered and the stakes are raised, and Harper has to face connections that she sees to the crime. I know that these are fictions, but how did you actually feel writing around the necessity of this violence for driving the story and driving the message of the story?
What do you mean the necessity of the violence? Like,
well, I mean, it's probably almost seems like a stupid question to ask. You've got a mystery that involves solving a murder, asking how do you feel about the fact that there is a murder? Of course, there wouldn't be a story without it, but what we learn at the end of the book is that there are particular patterns to what has been happening. And I wondered how you feel about the necessity of these patterns, the fact that the story moves forward with these two deaths of young women.
Well, I hate it. I wish we lived in a world where all I could do was write romance novels and everything was always happy endings and nobody had to check the locks on their windows or be scared of walking up to a panel van that's offering free kittens. And, you know, I hate it, but it's also the world we live in. And I believe in trying to reflect that. So, and trying to do it in the most realistic way possible with it still being kind of enjoyable to read, which I tell you, it's quite a fine line to walk, but hopefully I manage.
Now I'm gonna throw this last question at you with a spoiler warning. I'm not actually going to give anything away, but I think the point that you make in the book that I would like to discuss is such that people may want to avoid. So Harper has set herself the mission. She wants to be a reporter, and she has a stake in finding out what is happening. So as she goes out on her own to find the killer, she makes the all-too-real observation. People always want killers to be monsters. Nobody wants it to be the hot guy. And I wondered, do stories have a role to play in our conception that somehow dangerous people have these big flashing neon signs that say monster? They look like monsters. They act like monsters. And thus we ignore the regular person who is doing small, horrible things to influence or otherwise damage.
I don't know. I don't know that stories necessarily create that, or that, because, you know, you look at really old fables like Beauty and the Beast, and I mean, he's a lovely guy by the end, right? So on a very basic level, no, I don't think so. I think that they reflect human nature and our need to believe that somebody bad looks bad and acts bad and is bad, you know, because it makes us feel safer than believing that it could be the really good-looking guy who's totally charming and is good with kids. I mean, that's terrifying because that means that you can't trust anyone. So I think people, as humans, we would prefer to believe the other. And I remember reading a statistic actually about how much more likely you were to go to prison for murder if you were super unattractive. And I remember that really struck me. And I thought that was really wrong. And the other thing was you were more likely if you were a woman to get a really long sentence. And that really struck me. So
that sounds like it has some really interesting things to say about the way we feel as a society around breaking taboos. If you fail to, I guess, fulfill the role that someone has set for you, you will be punished more harshly.
Yes, exactly. And I was really exploring that throughout the entire novel, even with Harper's character, because she has pretty much rejected every societal script. She said, no, I don't want love and I don't want marriage and I don't want kids. I want to focus on my work and I want to not be clingy. And if I want to get rid of a guy, I can do that. And, you know, she has rejected a lot of societal scripts. So I suppose I was looking at that from a lot of different angles.
I want to reintroduce, I'm speaking with Pip Drysdale. We are discussing The Paris Affair. And Pip, thank you so much. We have taken a particular, line of exploration in this incredible story. I think we've successfully avoided spoiling your amazing mystery. And I really appreciate you taking the time, because this is just so much of this is so important to what I think men need to look at in the world today. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and for chatting.
That's it for this great conversation with Pip Drysdale. Pip's new novel, The Paris Affair, is out now from Simon & Schuster. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gundungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. If you want to stay in touch, we are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. If you subscribe in your podcast app, you'll get a new Great Conversation every week. Drop us a line, send us a rating. I would love to hear what you're reading. What are you enjoying right now? My name is Andrew Popel. I'll be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. Till then, happy reading.